Okay, today is Wednesday, April 26th, first day of Rosh Chodesh Iyar, 30th day of the month of Nisan. This is the women's Chumash Shir. We are in the middle of Sefer Bereshit. We'll begin today, Perek Yud Dalid of Sefer Bereshit. Okay, Rabotai. We are up to, we're starting today, Perek Yud Dalid of Sefer Bereshit. We did a fairly good job on Yud Gimel. I want to dedicate this year to the memory of Debbie Nachbar, whose mother, Basha Chaya Blima, Bas Abba Tzvi's Yartzeit was just 2 days ago on Monday. Certainly she should be very proud of her children and her grandchildren, one of which is making a major contribution to Jewish education in a variety of locales for Am Yisrael. Okay, so we're going to start Perek Yud Dalid. Perek Yud Dalid is a very interesting perek on account of the fact that at first glance it doesn't belong in the Torah at all, because it has nothing to do with any of the major characters of Sefer Bereshit. It happens to be that Lot will have been taken captive. But to spend an entire chapter on wars describing four kings and five kings who basically, at least at first blush, have nothing to do with us, simply because I want to tell you that Lot was taken captive, is very, very unusual. And the Torah spends an awful lot of time dealing with this particular issue. It's an entire chapter consisting of 24 verses, especially recognizing the fact that often we learn out what's called tilei halachot. We learn out mountains and mountains of halachot from one extra word, one extra letter. So the Torah is often very sparse in terms of its descriptions of a variety of mitzvot. And yet here is going to allocate 24 psukim to an event which at first blush doesn't seem terribly relevant to our understanding of the development of the Avot. So what we will see this morning is, first of all, who the participants are, and then three or four theories. The Ramban will be number one. I selected something that the Rav had written about why this unit is so critical for us. There are two midrashim that offer a perspective. That's the agenda for today. So let's just get our feet wet and just try to get a sense of who the participants are and what may have triggered this battle in the first place. So the Torah writes, Vayehi bimei Amraphel melach Shinar, person by Amraphel, the king of Shinar, 2, Aryoch melach Elasar, 3, Kedor Laomer melach Elam, Visidal melach Goyim, 4. So there were four kings. Asu milchama, they engaged in war at Bera Melech Sodom, number one. The at Birsha Melech Amora, 2. Shinav Melech Adma, number 3. Shem Ever Melech Tzvoyim, number 4. Umelech Bela, he Tzohar. So it's the four kings against the five kings. Kol Eile Chavru El Emek Hasidim, all of these gathered to a place called Emek Hasidim, and if you want to know exactly where within Eretz Yisrael it is, who? Yam HaMelech. It's near the Yam HaMelech. We've all been to the Yam HaMelech, so we know it's somewhere in the south, in Eretz Yisrael. That's where this battle is taking place. Now, Shteim Esrei Shana Avdu Et Kedor LaOmer. The head honcho of the group of four, he was Kedor LaOmer. And for 12 years, all of the other five, actually not only the other five, all eight worshipped and paid taxes to Kedor LaOmer. They all worshipped and paid taxes to him. He was the head honcho. Uba uba arba'es u'shlosh esrei shana maradu. In the 13th year, the five kings decided to rebel. And they're not paying taxes anymore to Mr. Kedor LaOmer. So what happens now, you have five who were rebelling, and Kedor LaOmer has an alliance with three others who still remain faithful and loyal to him. Uba arba esrei shana, and in the 14th year, ba Kedor LaOmer v'hamlachim asher ito, and so Kedor LaOmer and his other three join together and they wage war against one another. And the Torah will go on to, we're going to stop right here, Torah will go on to describe some of the features of the war, later tell us that Lot was taken captive, Avram was informed, he gets prepared to go into battle. That'll be the rest of it. As I said, our task today is to understand, why does the Torah tell us this piece of information in the first place? So if you will take your sheet, and you will be take, as we will begin with, as we usually do, I would normally, of course, start with Rashi. But Rashi doesn't address this particular issue. So I can't start with Rashi today. I can use Rashi in explaining the text, which we will. But I can't start with Rashi because he doesn't raise the point. Thus, Epis, the Torah is spending 24 psukim on this type of an issue. So take a look at the Ramban on page number 1. Vayihi bimei Amraphel Melech Shinar. Hama'aseh hazeh ira le'Avraham. This episode took place with Avraham. He was somehow tangentially involved. Lehorot, to teach him, ki arba malchuyot ta'amodna limshol ba'olam. Ubisof yitgabru banav aleihem ve'yiplu kulam biyadam. Ramban's theory is that every episode in Sefer Bereishis is a glimpse, as we've seen many a times before, Ma'aseh Avot Siman Lebanim. So there are going to be four nations, four times of captivity, that the Jews are going to be taken captive, suppressed, and oppressed, and eventually they're going to defeat each and every one of them, until the final battle will take place, when all of the world will finally recognize Bayom Hahu Yiyeh Hashem Echad Shmo Echad. So according to the Ramban, there is nothing significant about the details of this particular battle. What is important? Just the idea that there is going to be a battle, and the battle involves four kings. Those four kings represent four malchuyot, four kingdoms that eventually will oppress, starting with the Babylonians, the Greeks, the Romans, and so on and so forth. And each time, Am Yisrael will defeat one of the enemies until the last one will come, as is described in the book of Zechariah. We read about it. We didn't read about it. We will read about it on Chol HaMoed Sukkot. The battle, what's called Gog Umagog. whoever that nation is, but it's the final battle before the arrival of the Messianic era, during which Am Yisrael militarily demonstrates its might, and enables every other nation to succumb and to recognize the power of God and to accept the authority of Medinat Yisrael upon the rest of the world. That's what, says the Ramban, is the reason for this particular episode. And V'yashivu kol shvutam urechusham. Anybody who was taken captive, Shevi, everyone who was taken captive by any of these nations, and all of their loot, all of their possessions, all of the paintings that were taken by the Nazis that were initially painted as that very famous movie depicted, will all be returned to Am Yisrael. V'haya harishon mehem melech Bavel. The first one was the king of Babylonia after we were exiled from Eretz Yisrael the first time. It does not begin with Shibud of Paro. Does not begin because Paro was before we conquered Israel. So these are attempts to eradicate the promise that God will describe, the covenant that God will make with Avram in the very next chapter, in chapter 15, which we call the Brit Ben Abtarim. So there were nations that didn't want to believe in the covenant that the Jew is to be forever linked to Israel. That's why we start with Nebuchadnezzar, Melech Bavel, because he's the first one to challenge Am Yisrael post Am Yisrael's original settlement in Eretz Yisrael. And then he goes through some of the others, but that is the theory of the Ramban. That, and in some way, he spends some time, it's hard to understand, how each one of these names somehow makes a reference to either the Greeks, the Romans, the Babylonians. I'm not interested in trying to stretch out the idea, but that's the Ramban's theory. That's why we're going to learn these 24 psukim, because it will symbolically give the children of Avraham an inkling as to what to expect sometime down the road in Jewish history. Yes?
Couldn't it be also the same way it said the Amori was in the land, that Avraham was fighting other people the whole time he was getting the land? Like, that these kings were living in Israel and they were going to fight for their territorial rights?
Yes. You could say that, but the Ramban didn't. But what you're saying, you could say that. There's one medrash that might support what you're saying. But we'll see in a minute. So this, yes, question.
Why these premonitions, why these foretellings in all of these cases? In order to allow B'nai Israel to avert this fate?
No. There is no averting. Okay, no, okay, so that's an excellent question. That is an excellent question. So, and your question has been asked.
Yeah.
The answer is, it can be averted. When, just because HaKadosh Baruch Hu sees that there is going to be a battle at a certain time, doesn't mean that it's guaranteed to happen. You know why it's guaranteed to happen? Because he knows we will have done nothing to avoid it. But the reason why a premonition is shared by God to Abraham and Yitzchak and Yaakov is because HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants them to know that I have something in store and there is something you can do about it. If you only mend your ways, if you only change your behavior, this will not happen. So the mere fact that God has, a vision doesn't mean that vision must necessarily unfold. It will unfold not because God saw it and he can't be wrong, Because God can change his mind. He changes his mind every year. If not for changing his mind, we might as well not fast on Yom Kippur. God makes changes. He makes judgments on Rosh Hashanah, like we read, Berosh Hashanah Yikosevun. But it's not signed and sealed until Yom Kippur. So when God looks at your behavior between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, he can say, you know what? I made this decision. X, I'm Xing it out. So that's exactly what's happening here. It's an excellent question. Every one of these events is alerting us to the possibility of something happening, but we and we alone possess the ability to change the course of history if we only take advantage of that opportunity. Only taking advantage of the opportunity. And nobody said it any better than the Rav in his famous essay, Kol Dodi Dofek. I hear the knocking on the door. I hear the knocking on the door. That was the Rav's defense of his abandoning the tradition of his family to support the Aguda and to abandon and become the president of Mizrahi. Because he felt that God, in 1948, was knocking on the door. Right? My lover is knocking on the door, and they weren't answering the door. So there are times when HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us opportunities in history, and we don't take advantage of it. So the Rav felt that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was knocking on the door, let's open up the door and welcome them in. And that's why he recognized that Medinat Yisrael is something that it was inspired, originated with God's blessing. All we have to do is take advantage of it and develop it. As opposed to every other member of his family, father, his uncle, every one of them, remained dead fast Agudanists who did not feel that this was necessarily God knocking on the door, introducing it. So here, according to the Ramban, all the Sefer Bereishis, God's knocking on the door and letting you know about something, and let's see what you're going to do about it. But it's an excellent question. That's explanation number one. Explanation number two is right below it. You have the Ora Chaim, who in two lines simply said something else. And he writes, Ta'am Seder Hoda'at Ha'inyan. The reason for the structure of letting us know this entire episode, Lomar, Ki Arba'a Melachim Elu Takifim Hayu. These four kings were incredibly powerful. Now, Seyuman, like we say in the Haggadah, Seyuman, I want you to learn something. Ozar Elohim, She'im Avram, Asher Machaha Arba Milachim, Bechatzi Halayla, Ushar Hato Eliot. Exactly. Vahi Bechatzi Halayla. That in a half a night, what did God do? Avraham had gathered, as we will see, a big army of 318 people. And they were like less than the Israeli army in 1947. No arms. They were never soldiers. They were carpenters and electricians. And now you're fighting a war. And look. Look. HaKadosh Baruch Hu defeated them. And how long did it take them? A half a night. Vayhi b'chatzi halayla. So according to Aruch Hayim, this is not a forewarning for anybody else. This story is simply quoted and shared with us to demonstrate the power of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That if a member of Am Yisrael is in trouble, and one of his loyal ones, Avram, was in trouble because he felt a necessity to fight on behalf of Lot. His nephew had been taken captive. He decided to go to war. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I got to protect my buddy Avraham. And look how I did it. I take on the four most powerful nations around, and I beat them in a half a night. By midnight, the fight was over. So the purpose is to demonstrate that if you have a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God will go to the nth degree to protect you if necessary. To the nth degree. No matter what it is, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will do, will take the necessary steps. That's why the Torah engages in its description. And that in itself is an important lesson to know that if you trust Yisrael B'tach Bashem, then he is Ezram Umaginam Hu. Then HaKadosh Baruch Hu helps us and is our protector. And if he's our protector, we have nothing to worry about. Absolutely nothing to protect, to worry about. So that's a second explanation as to why this chapter has been told, to demonstrate HaKadosh Baruch Hu's concern and power for those who are loyal to him. Go to page number 2, please. And this is lifted from the Rav's commentary on Sefer Bereshit. So you can read it yourself. Read the entry, Vayhi Be'Me'am Raphael. I'll give you 2 minutes to read it. And you tell me what the Rav said as to what his theory, why this chapter happens to be recorded to Sefer Bereshit. It's not like the Ramban, and it is not like Or HaChaim. The way this Sefer was put together, there's this one individual who is like has a phenomenal memory, and whenever the Rav made a comment about something in Sefer Bereshit, any place in the world, he wrote it up, either or quoted it, and put it in its proper location. That's how he got the Sefer. Because the Rav never wrote anything on Sefer Bereshit. He wrote, you know, on a chapter on Abraham's journey that he did write. But so here it says, this is in a lecture in Boston in 1973. So somebody told him that there was a lecture in Boston where the Rav spoke about this pasuk, about this chapter. So he puts it in the Sefer. That's how the whole Sefer. His name is Dr. Arnie Lustiger. He lives in Highland Park. And he is never studied with the Rav formally, but used to come to the Rav's Moriah Shir in Midtown on 80th Street and Broadway, upstairs on top of the supermarket. There was a shul, and the Rav gave a shir every Tuesday night for 2 hours, which I had the privilege of attending for 12 years. And it was a great shir, an hour and a half Gemara, half hour on the Parsha, which we already read last week. He says, I'm not going to spoon feed you drusha for this Shabbos. If you can remember it for next year, that's fine. But I'm not spoon feeding you drusha. So he always spoke on the previous parsha. So here, this was in Boston. So what's the Rav's idea about this entire unit? It's to teach us something about the destiny of Am Yisrael. That for one reason or another, no matter what is happening in this world, we are going to somehow get dragged in and often blamed as the source of that particular event. There's something going to happen. And initially, it's just 4 kings against 5 kings, and Avram has nothing to do with this. But eventually, he's going to get involved. Why? Lot's going to be taken captive. Just to show us that if we analyze certain events in Jewish history, and there are many such events in Jewish history that can be understood under those ways, we don't have to look too far in our distant history, in our recent history. If you study the history of Germany, of World War I and World War II, the Jews were the least the problematic people of anybody in Germany, and yet we get blamed for their economic woes, their isolationism, whatever it is, the domination of some of the other victors, and we get blamed and we suffer the consequences. So how does HaKadosh Baruch Hu communicate to us that this is part of our reality, that Am Yisrael will be blamed for events that happen? This story serves as the paradigm for such an event. So today, whenever there are discussions any place in the world, it's the Palestinian-Israeli problem that is the main problem of the Middle East. 460,000 people have died in Syria, and that's not an issue. The Palestinian struggle, Hamas, and that's the most biggest problem. You solve that problem, every problem of the world has been taken care of. That lesson being taught to us is communicated through this particular episode. That is the suggestion of the Rav. Please then turn to page number 3. Where the Baal HaTurim, the author of the Tur, whose commentary on Chumash has been printed in most. It's not printed in the Torah Tzoras Chaim, but in the regular Mikraos Gedolos Chumash, they printed the commentary of the Tur. He is struggling to find a connection between the end of Perek Yud Gimel and the beginning of Perek Yud Aleph. Now, there doesn't have to be any connection. Doesn't have to be. The Torah often goes from one topic to the next topic. One topic to the next topic. And in fact, the way the Torah often indicates to us that topic A is not at all related to topic B is by using one of the two methodologies in the Torah to indicate that there is a new topic going on. It's called a psucha and a stuma. In the Torah itself, and one day I'll take out the Sefer Torah, you'll see it inside. The Sefer Torah is written on lines. The lines you can see in there, scratched out. It's called sirtut. It must have that scratched out line, only to make it for penmanship purposes. So it should be written nicely, not sloppily, writing like, everything's in a straight line. So there are two ways to end the topic. Number one is called a psucha. Psucha means open, where the remainder of that line is totally empty. So story A comes to an end, after two words on that line. Only two words were needed on that line. The rest of the line, which can fit in another 10 words, remains empty. And the next topic begins on the line below. That's called a psucha. A stuma means it's a closed line. There is a gap of 9 letters between story A and story B, but story B, after the space of 9 letters, story B resumes on that very same line, so the line is closed. That's why it's called a stuma. In the Chumash, they tell you whether it's a stuma or a psucha, either by writing a pei or a samach. A pei or a samach. That's how they do it in the Chumash. Now, in the Torah Chaim, they don't put peis and samach in the Torah Chaim, but they leave the line, either they leave the line blank, they leave the line blank, or they would start, Vayihi would be somewhere on this line, you know, after a space. So as you can see, the last word of Perek Yud Gimel, Vayivin Sham Mizbeach Hashem, there's nothing on the rest of the line. So it's a psucha. And a psucha is considered a greater break than a stuma. So once it's a psucha, you can say the Torah is just moving on to something else, and there is no necessity to what? To say there's got to be a connection between A and B. There doesn't have to be. Sometimes there is, sometimes there isn't. In this particular situation, most Parshanim ignored any connection between the two stories. But the Balaturim did. The Balaturim did. And in fact, many times halachic symbolism is derived from the way you arrange things. If A is written next to B, there's got to be a reason for it, and you can derive halachic significance, especially in Sefer Dvarim. We derive halachic significance, I'm going to show you an example, simply by the fact that A is written next to B. I'm going to show it to you in a second. But here, the Tur says, I think there is a connection. So what's the last phrase in chapter 13? Vayivin Sham Mizbeach Lashem. What's the first topic in 14? About a milchama. About going to war. So let's see, let's read inside the Tur what he says is the message for us. It's on the bottom of the page, of page 3. Vayivin Sham Mizbeach. V'samich lei vayhi bimei Amraphel melech Shinar asu milchama. Remez lo, this is done for as a remez, as a hint, a reminder. Shetzrichim banav lehavi korban kodem shietzu la milchama. That every single time you plan to go out on war, before you go out to war, what should somebody do? Usually the Beis Din should build a mizbeach. Fahainu dechsiv, and this is confirmed by a verse in the Psalms, which is recited every day, except today we didn't say it because it was Rosh Chodesh, right after Ashrei, the second time Ashrei, Lamnatzeach Mizmor LeDavid. So the pasuk says, "Yizkor kol minchosecha." God will remember all of the korban minachot, flower offerings that we bring. Ve'olacha and your korban ola yedash nesela. You will find meaningful to you Hakadosh Baruch Hu forever. Then what will happen? Yitein v'chaki v'avecha v'cholatzoscha yimalei neranina bishuasecha. We will be delighted in your anticipated salvation, and then afterwards, we'll be shame Eloheinu nidgol. Mazen nidgol, coming from degel. What do you do when you triumph in battle? You put up your flag. This is now my territory. Says the Tur. You want to know what this unit is here for? It's the follow up on Vayiven Sham Mizbeach. To teach us how to go to battle. That whenever it is necessary for Am Yisrael to go to battle, you must build a mizbeach and offer prayer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for success and for the safe return for all of the soldiers. For all of the soldiers. So, okay, I want to show you two things in Sefer Dvarim. One, how significance plays when one is next to the other. Like I said, here we're in the narrative. Nobody said anything except for the Torah. In Sefer Dvarim, we not only think that there is connections of the narrative, but even halachically speaking. So please open up to Deuteronomy chapter 23, Dvarim chapter 23 for a minute. Let me just say it's not to get through the puzzle. Thank you.
It is Parshas Ki Tetzé.
Okay, here it is. It's actually chapter 22, verses Yud Aleph and Yud Bet. So I'm going to start with verse Yud for a second. The Torah writes, Lo tacharosh b'shor v'chamor yachdav. You are not permitted to plow using two different type of animals together at the plow. An ox and a chamor, and a donkey. You can't. Okay? That's called kilayim behema. Then the Torah talks about what we call shatnez. Lo tilbash shatnez. What is shatnez? Tzemeru pishtim yachdav. Linen and wool together. Good. Then you see that is there a blank afterward yachdav? There's a samach, right? It's a stuma. So here comes a new topic. What's the new topic? Gidilim ta'aselach al arba kanfot kisutcha asher techaseba. Means you're supposed to put tzitzis on the four corners of your garment. Good. Very nice. You can say that, don't forget, Sefer Dvarim is just a review of lots of all the other halachot that we already learned. But for some reason, Moshe Rabbeinu, who is the author of Sefer Dvarim, as opposed to the rest of the Chumash, the authorship is attributed to God, Moshe decided to put shatnez and tzitzis next to one another. Because it was authored by humans, a human has a brain, like you and like me. We have brains. And therefore we can ask a person who has a brain, what was running through his mind by putting A next to B? You can't necessarily ask that question in Sefer Vayikra. Because who is the author of Sefer Vayikra? HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We can't ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu or read into his mind why he decided to put this mitzvah next to that mitzvah. So in all other Chumashim, we do not derive any halachic significance out of the fact that one pasuk is written next to the next pasuk. We do not. But in Sefer Dvarim, we do. What do we learn out from this particular closed thing? A very halachic, significant rule. That whenever there's a conflict between a positive commandment and a negative commandment, the positive commandment overrides the negative commandment. Meaning, you buy a four-cornered linen garment. The tzitzis have to be made out of wool. Should I be putting tzitzis on a linen garment or not? On a four-cornered linen garment? Okay. Well, the first pasuk says you're not allowed to wear shatnez. So you would say no. The second pasuk says you're supposed to put tzitzis on a four-cornered garment. So you're supposed to. Well, which one is it? So the fact that they're written next to each other teaches us a halachic principle. Aseh doche lo ta'aseh. That a positive commandment always overrides a negative commandment. Always overrides a negative commandment. So that's number one. So I show you, and I can show you 50 such examples in Sefer Dvarim, and there you'll never find the Parshanim ignoring the smichut of mitzvot or anything. Because Sefer Dvarim was written differently. Sefer Dvarim was authored by Moshe 33 days before he died. We know the date. He tells us the date. It was Rosh Chodesh 37 days. It was Rosh Chodesh Shvat. That's when the beginning of Sefer Dvarim is. The date is given. And we know he died on the seventh day of Adar. So with 37 days, he wrote, he spoke the whole Sefer Dvarim. At the end of it, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, Moshele, that was a fantastic drasha. Please write it down. And I'm going to put it into my Torah. That's why the nickname of Sefer Dvarim is called Mishneh Torah. Because it started out as Mishneh, oral law. It was Moshe's words. Then became part of what? A part of God's Torah. And now has the same sanctity level as any other of the previous Chumash. But since it was authored by Moshe Rabbeinu, we have a right to assume that his brain was operating like us. Why did you put A before B? And B after A? Yes. What?
Is that limited to Sukkim only?
Yes, Smichut. So, no, all topics.
So then why do we have the question of Ma'inyan Shmita Eitzel HaSinai? Why would that happen?
No.
Because Rashi says
no, that. No, that question, Ma'inyan Shmita Eitzel HaSinai, is nothing to do with Smichut. That question is, what does this have to do with the price of tea in China? Because the Torah introduces the mitzvah of Shemitah by saying, Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe behar Sinai lemor. Now, did you say the parsha of Tzitzit this morning? Of course you did. Did you say Vayomar Hashem el Moshe behar Sinai lemor? Daber? No. Because what assumption do we make? Everything was given at Sinai. So what question do you think Rashi asks at the beginning of Parshas Bahar, Vayikra chapter 25, Ma'inyin Shmita Eitzel Har Sinai. Why do I have to write specifically that the mitzvah of Shmita was given in Har Sinai? But it's nothing to do with Smichus. It just said, what's the status of the price of tea in China? You know, who cares? Of course it was given at Sinai. Every mitzvah was given at Sinai. Why does so everybody asks that same question and gives their own answer? Everybody's got an answer. Everyone has an answer. I also have an answer. But it's not for now. I have a really good answer also. Yeah. Maybe I'll tease you. I'll say 1 second. But anyhow, I want to show you something else about Sefer Dvarim in the context of what the Baal HaTorim just said. Please open up, go a little back to Parshat Shoftim. Chapter 20, at the beginning, chapter 20. Verse 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on and so forth. Chapter 20 in Book of Dvarim. Ki teitse la milchama al oivecha. Should you decide to go out in battle against your enemy. Viraita sus varechev am rav mimcha. And you'll notice that the enemies have far more missiles than we do. Far more missiles. And that the Egyptian Air Force on June 6th, 1967, far more planes than the Israeli army had parked on the ground. Lo tira mehem. Don't be afraid of them. Why? Ki Hashem Elokecha imach hama'alcha me'eretz Mitzrayim. God is with us, who took us out of Mitzrayim, against all odds, so he can do it again. And he has done it. But now listen to what I want to show you. V'haya kikor v'chem el ha-milchama v'nigash ha-kohen v'diber el ha-am. there is a Kohen who is called a Kohen Mashuach Milchama. Maza Mashuach, anointed. The Kohen who is anointed to speak to the charges before the war. So he does several things that are here. In the text, it comes out where he gives them a rally, a rallying cause, rallying. Don't be afraid. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the pasuk which we conclude, the tefillah for Tzahal, Ki Hashem Elokechem, Hu Elokechem Echem, Hu Yilachem Echem, El Hoshiach Echem, is taken right out of his speech in this chapter. Then he also goes around, he goes to deal with situations who might not be in the best position to be courageous fighters, because they have things on their mind. They just got married, they built a house, and somebody else might, they got all kinds of excuses. And cowards. Ish hayarei v'rach halevav. So simple pshat means I'm afraid, I'm a coward, or you're afraid of an aveira which you may have done, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will use this as an opportunity to have you executed during the war as payment. So what does the Kohen tell these people? Yelech v'yashov lebeito. You're exempt from battle. Fine, very nice. This is only talking about milchemet reshut, an optional war which the king wages because he wants to expand territory and things. For milchemet mitzvah, for whether it is, and there are three types of wars that are milchemet mitzvah. One, eradicate Amalek. Two, conquering Israel. Three, protecting a Jew any place in the world. And Tebi was a milchemet mitzvah. These exemptions don't apply. Everybody has to be going to war. And the Gemara's expression is, afilu chatan vekala mechupatam. They can be standing under the chuppah, and both the kala and the chasan have to participate in the war effort. Fine. Very nice. So some parshanim add, why a kayin? What is after Kayin who gives the speech? Why a Kayin? So now tell me, in light of the tour, what do you think this Kohen is going to be doing in addition to giving a big
Karban.
Exactly. The Kohen, when he gets finished with his what? With his big speech, he's going to the Mishkan, or the Mikdash, and he's going to be bringing a Karban, asking HaKadosh Baruch Hu to bring about a successful conclusion and as few casualties as possible. So the Torah doesn't just make this up. The Torah itself supports the fact by designating a special Kohen. He was anointed with that special oil, the Shemen HaMishcha, and he's called a Kohen Mashuach Milchama. No other Kohen can do this. Only him. Only him. So I would imagine that before the Kohen Gadol, or the Bezdin, decided that which Kohen is going to be the Mashiach Mechama, they did their homework. It's not just any ordinary Tom, Dick, and Harry Kohen. It must have been a special Kohen who really was worthy of the trust of HaKadosh Baruch Hu to make that. So that's a third, theory that this is designed to teach us, that as we are going to go into battle, because in the next chapter, God's going to make the covenant with Avram to guarantee that what? We will conquer Israel. So before you're going to conquer Israel, what am I telling you? Follow the previous pasuk, Vayiven Sham Mizbeach Lashem. Good. Go to page number 4 for a minute, which is a medrash. Vahibi me'am Raphael Melech Shinar. The Medrash spends lots of time proving that this guy Amraphel is just a nickname, and he was really somebody else who was very famous. His name was Nimrod, correct. And why was he called Nimrod? Because he was Marad Bashem. He rebelled against God and tried to encourage others. Says the Medrash, Rabbi Yeshua de Sichnin, Rabbi Yeshua of the city of Sichnin, B'shem Rabbi Levi Patach, opened up his drasha with the following midrash. Quoting the Pasuk in Tehillim, Cherev Patchu Rishaim, when a Rasha begins using what? A sword? Charbam Tavo Bilibam. Their own swords are what? Going to what? Kill them by stabbing them in the heart. Then he goes through the whole thing. What are you talking about? Who was the one who forced Avram, according to the Midrash, this is not recorded in the text, into the Kivshan Ha'esh to prove his loyalty to God? Nimrod. Ah, very nice. So we all know of that story. When we were in pre-K, we heard that story of Nimrod. And if you just read the text and you believe the Midrash, what does it look like? Looks like Nimrod got away with it. Avram came out, but Haran did not. Avram's brother jumped in and died. He was burnt in the fire. And there was no recourse taken. Nobody ever got measure for measure. Says Rabbi Yeshua ben Diskin, no. We're taking care of him. You know why the Torah is going to tell us this story about Amraphel? Because I want you to know that Nimrod was killed in battle. Because he used the cherev initially by telling Avram, if you're not jumping into the fire, I'm going to stab you. Well, he didn't get away with it. He was killed during this course of battle by use of the sword. What?
Like Bilam.
Precisely like Bilam. Yes. And as a result, this is why the Torah is telling us. To let us know that if there are people who try to harm members of Am Yisrael, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will do just as we recited today in the Shir Shel Yom of Yom Revi'i. Kael Nikamot Hashem, Kael Nikamot Hofia. God takes revenge. Here is HaKadosh Baruch Hu taking revenge against Amraphel. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu does it in a manner which is the manner of the 99% of the time. It doesn't look like he's involved. HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't come down here and strike Nimrod with a lightning bolt. That's not what happened. There was a battle for power. And Nimrod happened to have gotten killed. But who's standing behind the scenes, of course? HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu usually operates. He orchestrates certain events, and then by analyzing those events, we can see, must have been HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the background, playing in the background. So according to the Midrash, that's a fourth perspective for the reason for the Torah spending 24 psukim on this unit. To let you know that if you have a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu and you try to threaten or to injure my yidid, my friend, I promise you I will act upon my words. Kael Nikamot Hashem. I am the God who seeks vengeance and will act upon that in the manner which I see fit. So we began with the question as to what's the purpose of this particular unit, and we've seen four different perspectives. And next week, Emirat Hashem will continue moving on into the text itself, see what happens and what unfolds in the story itself.